Good afternoon, I'm Roger Watterson, and this is Sunday Opinion. The 2016 general election is over, and the chosen 24 will be sworn in next week to serve as members of the House of Keys for the next 5 years. And there are 12 newcomers to the Parliament. Almost immediately, they'll get down to business to choose a new Chief Minister. And throughout the months leading up to polling day, we heard a lot from the 62 candidates as they made their pitch for a seat. But behind the scenes was a large number of professional people working with the newspapers and radio and TV stations who interviewed and quizzed the candidates, queried their manifestos and policies, recorded and reporting on the meetings, maintained a special election websites and monitored the social media, and on election night brought you the results as they happened together with informed comment and analysis. But since Thursday, we've heard from the public and former politicians about the result and its implications as they see it. Now it's the turn of the journalists, who throughout the campaign were obliged to report fairly, objectively, and without expressing any bias or opinion right up to 8 o'clock on Thursday evening on polling day. Well, the gag is off, and they can now tell us what they thought about it all. So with that in mind, I'm pleased to introduce our studio guests today. They are Manx Radio's news editor, Marion Kenny, the editor of Isle of Man newspapers, Richard Butt, and from MTV, I always dropped it off, Paul. This is Paul Moulton. Anyway, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being with us today. Well, Marion, I've just said there, the radio has a great deal more restrictions sometimes on it than the newspapers do. So there are, right throughout the campaign, there's a great tendency for us all to have to bite our tongue on occasion as it goes on, isn't it?
Well, as journalists, we don't express our opinion anyway. That eats into any credibility issues. And we started our coverage. It was going to be the straight after TT, but because of the EU referendum, it was actually the week after that. So this has been going on since, I don't know, the third week of June. Paul's been coming in every morning to do the filming for the candidates into mandate, and we've just got into a groove, really. We've interviewed everybody more than once. We've had our studio debates, we've had our constituency profiles, we've had our man on the park bench interviews. But yes, all through, we maintain, you know, a complete lack of bias. Everybody gets exactly the same run at it. I'm just wondering what on earth we're going to do now, because we've all been living, breathing, eating and sleeping the election for so long. I've got a bad case of post-election blues, Roger.
Really, right. Well, those all symptoms go away after a while. But tell me, what's your general impression then, of this election? If I said to you, well, sum it up in a few words, what would you say?
I can't sum it up in a few. I mean, okay. Newbies have arrived in the chamber. That's the big picture to me. On election night, we were busy processing. It was a factory down there in the newsroom. Richard will have had a completely different experience to me. He could listen and watch and make notes and have thoughts. We were processing, you know, interviews that were coming, that were going out live on air, and putting them on the news within minutes, putting our clips and our stories onto the website. Communicating the news in various different social media channels. There was very, very little time on the night to actually reflect on what was happening. A few things I thought, wow, gosh, he's gone and she's in. But it was no more than that at the time. It was really 24 hours later, for me anyway, having sort of worked through the night and read the news the next day, when I actually sort of sat back and thought, what have we got here? It's not blood on the walls. It's not shockwaves through the system. It is, I think, the new wave of, I mean, there's a great well of goodwill and good intentions out there. All these new people desperate to roll up their sleeves and start working for the island. I remember Rob Collister saying that. You know, it's now thinking about, what do we want them to actually roll up their sleeves and do? All this goodwill, all this well of potential is coming in. How it's going to play out and how they're going to make their mark and what are going to be their priorities is going to be absolutely fascinating to watch. And I'm sorry, that's not summing up in a few words. But to me, it's the intake of freshers that really strikes me.
Now, Paul, all through this, as Marion just said, you videoed every one of the 62 candidates
The ones who wanted to do it, actually three or four didn't or couldn't or wouldn't, you know, because everyone didn't do those interviews. It's a shame because you think their massive moment this is, and 4 minutes in front of a camera can actually make people's minds up. This day and age, people like to look up at the people and, you know, how they react and can they take the questions. I mean, we had some very diverse ones. I mean, obviously you had three different people doing the interviews, which also affects how those interviews are going, because some people
different styles.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, the most viewed videos were the ones that are the most controversial, or the people who didn't really grasp how the whole process should be done. That's the interesting thing, but people actually went out of the way to look at those videos for the car crash moment, mm-hmm. or something that the candidates were saying which was completely different to what other people were saying.
But is this, though, is sort of human nature? They like to see somebody backed into a corner. It may have a lot to do with basic politics.
I would say the question is, if people don't do those interviews, why are they standing to be an MHK in the first place? I mean, really, if you can't sit through an interview, you're really not in the right place.
Looking back on all those 62 or 60, whatever number you did now.
I thought it was 63 candidates. Yeah. They didn't all do an interview.
That's right.
Well, nevertheless, a significant number of them did.
Oh, yeah, most.
Did they, do you think, sort the men from the boys?
Well, it was pressure on them. I mean, a lot came in and they were sitting there as if they were going into the dentist chair.
Mm. I mean, there were a few on election night when a microphone was put in front of them. The reporters have said to me, no names, obviously. People looked like they were a rabbit stuck in the middle of the road in the headlights. It's like, wow, I've done it. What am I going to say now?
I spoke to a guy who...
Richard Bugg.
He was just standing and he said, why haven't you done anything about me? He said, well, you didn't let us know you were standing, which is a big issue. And then I started asking questions. Oh, I can't answer these questions. You haven't let me prepare. And I was asking very straightforward questions. And I thought, this guy can't really, you know, hack it. He won't actually stand up well in the election itself, and he didn't get it. I mean, there was quite a lot of naivety, perhaps, about the candidates there.
It is hard to prep for this, although I think one company is offering advice on how to do it. Yeah. But, you know, at the end of the day, for most people, it is a brand new experience. But
the
journey begins then.
But if you don't know what you think, for instance, about taxation, or you don't know what you think about a huge moral issue, and I sat in a requisition meeting where somebody literally didn't know what he thought about abortion, for instance.
Because they haven't thought about it, have they?
Exactly. Yeah. But if you're going to stand to be in the National Parliament, one would have thought you'd have worked out some sort of position. There was quite a few moments like that.
We asked a lot of questions in our papers, the same questions of each candidate in the week before, and we asked about public sector pensions. How should we deal with public sector pensions? Some people wrote reams and reams and reams. One candidate just said, carefully. So how should you deal with it? Carefully. You know, you get a real feel for some candidates just from that sort of interaction, really.
Roger, you're mentioning how media covers the events. I mean, what you need to also bring into this time around is social media. I mean, we're the video side. I don't think the rules even apply to us. I think it's more for the papers and the radio have strict... We adhere to it. But, you know, the forums, they don't. And Facebook doesn't. And their servers are anywhere but the Isle of Man, so there's probably no control can be put on people. That I think that's been an interesting side, that some of the things on those forums can be quite devastating, and you can just say what you want and
be wrong, and it just goes through without
being
you can't. You know, strictly speaking, we can in newspapers, because we could take a stance if we choose not to. But if you think about The Sun and its famous Neil Kinnock in the light bulb, if you vote for this man tomorrow, who's the last person to leave Britain, please leave. Turn out the lights. Now, in the UK, you've got 11 or 12 national papers, all of which have a particular line and will follow it, and their readers basically choose those papers because they more or less agree with them. Here, it's a very different situation. We choose not to do that, and we try to be objective and not have any bias.
But if you buy a newspaper in the United Kingdom, you're fairly certain before you buy it what its political leanings are going to
be. That's why you buy it.
Like the Daily Telegraph, Mail, Conservative, Mirror's, Labour, and so on. Guardian's Labour, Times, Conservative. So you expect this sort of... They also campaign, which is something that does not done in our media here. We just talked about it before. How objective do you think you have been?
Well, I think you can campaign. We campaigned to get the toilet tax, for example. We wanted it to be part of the
election time.
Election time, yes. We wouldn't campaign for a particular candidate or against a particular candidate, but we would.
Some might disagree with you on that because there's two things. Mr. Faulkner and Mr. Horton might have an opinion of Mr. Butt on that.
Well, they might do, but I think they'd be wrong. We had no scurrilous campaign, as Mr. Horton suggested, and Mr. Falk was concerned about a story around. But, you know, Mr. Falk had had carte blanche. He'd said in his manifesto all these things about the doom-laden Manx economy, and we thought, actually, it's responsible journalism to go and find out whether he's right or wrong.
Why didn't you do it before then?
Because, I mean, you actually contacted, as far as we can gather, you contacted the Treasury very, very close to the election and then published it on the eve of the election.
Yeah, but that's a good question. We were looking at it and we thought we need to do this. The Manx Independent was coming out of the next paper. That was the Election Day paper. Maybe we should have done it earlier. If we had done it earlier, of course, it'd say been the Examiner that week or previous week, then the people would have had more time to digest it, and it might have done him even more harm if it did any harm
but
at all to him.
Looking at it, you know, I think it was 50-50. It could have attracted 50% of people and turned another 50% off. I was just going to ask you, Richard, you haven't campaigned for or against policies or candidates on this. When there's a slate of chief ministerial candidates, broadcasting code doesn't allow us to do that, but would you in the paper say we think such a person is the best man or woman for the island?
I think it's unlikely. We might do when it comes to it. We might sort of take an editorial stance within our own comment columns, which are clearly listed as, you know, examine a comment or independent comment on the top of it, and we might say that person X is, we think, the best person for the job. That might do them more harm than good, I don't know. You know, we might do a poll for readers. So who do you think should be the next chief minister? Yeah. And find out what the views of the public are. It's a very difficult situation to get into. Well, I don't see there's a special, especially a front runner at the moment, and I don't know how their future's going to pan out.
And isn't that a problem? Because you asked all the candidates who they wanted or thought they, and didn't most not reply?
Most didn't.
But 5 years ago, it was Alan Bell, wasn't it?
Yeah, Alan Bell, I think, was the front runner at that time. Yeah. But at this time, we had lots of people choosing not to comment or saying, well, it depends who gets in,
which, of course, we didn't pursue it because the whole thing is totally hypothetical at that point. All those people, you know, if people had said, well, I think Phil Gawn would make a good one, you know, it's meaningless. He didn't get elected.
Exactly. Yeah,
but I think it's important that they do have an opinion. I think if you want Phil, then say Phil. What's the harm in doing that?
There's no
It shows
harm,
you've got an opinion.
Use.
You said people should have opinions on things and should have an answer for it. And there's a very question. It's not policy, but it is actually the person who's going to lead the Isle of Man for 5 years. What an important decision. And you should have your eye on one of those 23 other people who are already in. Okay, they may not get back in, but at least you've got a thought and a decision in your own head of who you would like to run the country.
But I think that a lot of people probably didn't or wouldn't want to do that because they thought it might queer the pitch for them if they said it was someone else. And as it happened, in reality, you know, another person gets in and they've already, you know, stuck their colours to the mast of someone else.
So they're learning to be politicians at that stage.
Well,
really.
If they didn't get in, then that's your excuse. You say, well, sorry, I did say Mr. Gawn, but he's not there, so I'll now have to re-evaluate my decision.
I would like to come back to the role of newspapers, not just in the election, but in the performance and conduct of the next government shortly, and that applies to the radio and TV as well, all of the media. But could you just go back to the election for a minute? All of you will have ploughed your way through all of the manifestos, both of the successful and unsuccessful candidates.
I'm still going through them, Roger.
Yeah, there's very few ideological dividing lines between any of them. They all seem to have the same shopping list. Now, is that because those are the same issues of public interest, or because actually they're somewhat bereft of any other ideas?
Well, as Alan Bell said, they've all been, you know, excellent at reciting all the problems and all the issues and what needs to be tackled. What we've been looking for are some answers. Now we know who's in the next House of Keys. We're going to be at them saying, well, you said this, that you wanted to tackle such a subject or such an issue and you thought you might like to do it in this way. What are you going to do? How are you going to raise it? How are you going to push that forward?
Well, there were a whole series of subjects. If you start to go through them and tick off the subjects, those that were fairly in common was growing the economy, public service pensions, TV licences for the over 75s, some with Brexit, Douglas Prom, size of government, government waste, population and health and education. And then there's a catalogue of others, but those came up at the top of the list. But when you read the manifestos, very few of them had, as you say, Marion, any answers to anything. They were just a wish list, really.
Yeah, they were. They were very, you know, very assiduous at setting out the problems. Not everybody. I mean, I did look at a manifesto this morning, and it actually had a 15-point plan for a vision for government with, you know, in an order, 1 to 15, this is what needs tackling. That was interesting. Because obviously now we can discard all the manifestos, the people that didn't get in, and just read those 12.
But I think that one of the big problems is, because of the system we have, a politician who gets in into the Keys wants such and such a thing on his agenda or her agenda, and the other 23 don't. And so they can't take it anywhere anyway. And so it's all about the actual composition of the Keys once they get in there, and interpersonal relationships before anything can actually happen. So there's a sense in which, because Manx politics isn't party-based and there's no real ideologies, you don't really know what's going to happen at the end of it, even after the election. Whereas if you're in a party political system, you know that David Cameron's party is going to do X, Y and Z, because that's what they said, and they might do X and Y, but perhaps not Z, but they're going to do a certain direction. And the problem with Manx politics, in a sense, is because we don't have party politics, we've no idea what will happen at the end of it.
We do have three Lib Vans in there now, so there is a little bit of party politics. And they got in. I mean, all the by-elections, Lib Vans didn't do well. And then come the general election, and three... I wasn't sure that was going to happen, wasn't it?
They got three last time as well.
Yeah, they did, but in the by-elections, they didn't score. So it's, something's happening there. Some people have decided they do like the policy, whatever that overall policy is. And there is the Manx Labour Party. Such.
I think because, as Richard rightly says, there isn't party politics, so the candidate, or now the new MHKs, aren't firmly sort of lined up behind a set of political philosophies. They've all got the wonderful things they said they wanted to look at and do. All that has got to be sort of channeled and corralled into a purpose. And so I think more than any other time at the start of this government, really early on, there has to be set out, this is what this government... You know, when there is a chief minister and a set of ministers, this is what we're going to try and achieve.
That's going to be difficult, isn't it, with 12 brand new people, three only of the others with more than one term, five with only one term, and four with less than 1 year. Everybody keeps comparing it to the 1976 period when there were 14 new members in the House. But in that, as I was saying before, in that period of time, and I was one of the 14 at that time, there were... still remaining in the House, 10 very experienced politicians in the form of Charlie Cruise, Clifford Irving, Percy Ratcliffe, and you could go on like that. There was a whole, Victor Neal, there was a series of them. So there was a base of experience. It looks worrying to me, this one. There isn't that base
there. I mean, now people who've perhaps just done one term, or in some cases two, are going to look like the old hands. And now, like you say, there isn't 15, 20 years' experience behind them.
Only three ministers back in. I mean, that's quite a big challenge to get a council minister of eight people.
And that's
Tim Crookall continues, of course. Mm-hmm. Then that's going to be very difficult to actually get a council minister. I mean, some of them haven't even been on boards of commissioners, and to not understand the way that works and simple
Richard,
things.
I'm not convinced that many of them have actually sat in Tynwald.
I'm sure that's
now,
true.
I'm prepared to be shouted down on that, but we go and sit in Tynwald, and we haven't seen... If you were standing for the House of Keys, would you not want to go and sit and immerse yourself in it and, you know, wonder at it and how does it work? And
well, they get an induction these days. They didn't used to, but they do get some sort of video maybe or shown round and how it all works.
I remember as a junior reporter watching George Waft take a bill through, and... they take a bill through, and they then have a lot of series of questions about, you know, what he's been going through. And instead of actually answering the questions, he just summarised what the question had been. And, you know, he hadn't been taken through any sort of induction. He didn't understand that process at that time. And I think that if you don't have any basis of actually going into Tynwald, going into the Keys, seeing what happens, just the basics of what actually happens in there, you are going to be stuck. And they'll probably be stuck for a couple of years, some of them, who haven't got used to that procedure.
If you go in there and look at it sometimes, you might get very disappointed about how low the level debate is, but how they all treat each other. They're passing sweets around, they're on their iPhones, they're, you know, this is why they probably don't want TV in there, but don't get me started on that one today. But, you know, but can we get back to the Chief Minister then, Dave? He's got this deck of cards. And as you said, the experience is going to be pretty low.
Yep.
So do you just go for all the people who have been in before just because they've been in before? Or do you go in there for the high flyers? I mean, one person like Shimmons, you know, he could be the new Eddie Tears, I think.
Could be.
But he's a banker. He's got some experience. He might be in Treasury before you know it. But do you take that risk and go with completely unknowns? Or do you just go for the ones that are left, which could be not necessarily the right choices?
Well, Roger, you've said it is quite worrying, and that is one way of looking at it. But I think really the only way that we collectively as an island, as a society, can look at it. We've got it. We've got to look at it positively. Sorry, there's a lot of energy. There's a lot of good intent. There's a lot of people prepared to work their butts off for the island. And, you know, there is that I think it's best. It's got to be best. And it's got to be reality to go with that and say, let's make a positive of it, rather than worrying about the lack of experience. Tap into what there is.
What might change the atmosphere and possibly the thinking in there is we'll have 5 women in there now. We should, of course, have 12 or 13. But having only had one member of the House of Keys as a woman, that's Kate Beecroft last time, I think the atmosphere will begin to change a bit because of those extra people.
So why should there be 13? I mean, what are you saying?
The population.
Are you saying discrimination, or are you simply saying...
No, I think that's the way it should go. I mean,
clearly,
we can have another heated debate here.
Clearly, there is something about society that makes it easier for men to stand and become politicians.
But you're not saying positive discrimination.
I'm not suggesting that at all. I just think we've moved in a good direction.
That's not entirely right, this election. Quite a few of the constituencies had quite a few women on the hustings. Mm. Douglas Central had an equal amount, 3-3.
So
I don't think the public is against voting for women. I don't think it's anything to do with whether they're men or women. I think it's to do with the quality of the candidate and how they perform.
But you really think that it's right? Last time we only had 2 women came in.
Can't just do it on statistics, can you?
Well, yes, I think you can in a sense, because, you know, there is something in society that means that there's prejudice in favour of men entering politics rather than women. And that just... that. Otherwise, you know, you would have equal numbers.
Some are saying that in some of the areas, if one woman was standing, they did get a lift because some people would go, I want a woman. So there's probably that. But once you've got more than one, it's just open to anything, isn't it, surely?
I think it'd be interesting to see if the debates are as lengthy as they sometimes are.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of busy multitasking women.
But debates get longer and longer as the time goes by. Every year the debates seem to get longer until you get to the year of the election and everybody has to say everything about everything. Mm-hmm. So it is a timescale. It's interesting to watch that because you can see them getting longer as the years go by.
But they've got a new House with so new members. Maybe there will be a fresh approach. Maybe there'll be a government of national unity. Remember that saying?
Well, didn't work, did it?
Yeah, but this, again, maybe the next Chief Minister will try again, because with so many new people, they haven't got any baggage with falling out with X or Y, have they
but
yet?
We've heard a lot of talk about needing to set a national agenda, needing to set the targets of the government, all those things which happened at the election. But nobody really discussed who was going to set those agendas. The Chief Minister can't set it on his own. The Council of Ministers, by the sound of it, might not. Some of them might not be all that experienced. So where does this pressure come from?
Paper, don't they? Mm. Agenda for... I mean, we've got a lot of strategies, and I was wondering what happens to them. You know, we've got a digital strategy, we've got a visitor destination strategy, we've got a food matters strategy, we've got Isle of Enterprise strategy, we've got Vision 2020. There's all these different things that are already in train. Do they fall by the wayside, or do they continue? Because they are based on a belief, ultimately a political belief, as to, you know, what should happen to those sectors.
But of course, those are at the moment in the hands of the administration, aren't they? The hands of the senior civil servants. I know we tend to get a little worried sometimes about this Humphrey situation. Alan Bell refuted it the other night when David Collister discussed it with him. But there is nevertheless, of course, the senior levels of the civil service are trained not to allow a vacuum. And if somebody doesn't take charge, somebody has to. Now, that is the question, isn't it? How does somebody who's very new at the job take charge?
Well, I think actually... maybe the civil servant who's been involved in a situation and an idea or a policy is actually going to be better placed in some ways than a brand new person coming in who's not really thought about those things. And there will be a period in which these politicians have to learn what's going on. So I'm sure that the civil servant's influence will be stronger now than it would have been under the previous administration.
And it will die away, ultimately, because there'll be a period where the new ministers and the new members are saying, just tell me again why we're doing this.
Yeah.
Why are we doing it this way? But as they gain confidence and knowledge and understanding, they might move in and say, right, this isn't... I'm talking about new ministers who may come from the inexperience.
Bell's comment was that, of course, the senior levels of the civil servant and the last House have been complaining they received an insufficient direction. So that was...
it might get worse.
So we're going to be... Sir Humphreys are in charge. Yeah.
I would say, looking at it, very often you know who's running the shop, and it's not the MHK necessarily. You do get the impression that they're being guided forcefully sometimes, even, because they change departments, people move in and out, but the policy overall seems to be staying the same. You know, the Sir Humphreys are probably running. That's not just here. That's probably everywhere, really. That behind the scenes, civil servants are their bosses.
Well, in some countries, the media can empower the electorate. They can give them the information that they need. They can do investigation that's not being done by the government. They can explain things that the government does its best not to explain. Mm-hmm. And there's a cost in doing that, of course. Investigative journalism can be very expensive. But nevertheless, is this now a situation where the various media throughout the island is now almost got an obligation to do more of this?
Financially, it's impossible over here, I think.
But. Well, you know, we've done plenty of investigation in the past. It might not be things that rock Tynwald, but, you know, I think that in terms of Mr. Horton, if we go back to him, you know, we talked about his pension, things like that, and he you know, we wasn't a campaign against him, but we discovered that one MHK wasn't paying for the pension. This didn't affect, I know what you're talking about, Roger, in terms of the full direction of the government, you know, how that progresses. But in a way, To tell the people what we think should happen. I'm not a politician. I'm not there to decide the future of the island or suggest what my priorities are. I think we're really there to report and then perhaps raise issues that other people have come to conclusions. You know, people are more expert than us in the business community and unions and things like that. But in terms of the Equality Act, you know, coming up, we could talk to all sorts of
groups. But in other countries, the newspapers and radio and TV in particular do just that. They do take issues. For instance, I'm not convinced at this last election that many of the issues that were in all the manifestos that we talked about was a sort of pack mentality there where they latched into all the issues. I'm not sure that some of the really important ones for the Isle of Man were ever represented in the debate.
Well, was tax ever talked about?
Yeah. Not much.
Not much.
No.
Back to investigative journalism. I think the biggest tool you've got is probably the Freedom of Information Act. As that comes in more and more, it's going to fully come in to be able to ask a question and potentially get an answer, because that's where you're going to get a lot of your main stories from.
Well, actually, access to information was very good beforehand. We got lots and lots of things from access to information.
Which was almost the same thing then, but
yeah,
they didn't
nearly
have to do it.
I mean, it started off very badly, but it got better and better as we used it and as
and you did
the
use
civil servants in particular actually understood it a bit better. In terms of freedom of information, there's one slight flaw with that from a journalistic point of view, is as soon as we put a query in, then that goes out to everybody and everyone can see it. So we don't get the exclusives that might sell newspapers that once upon we would have done under access. So freedom to information, very, very important. Everyone should have it. But there's a little bit of a flaw from a journalistic point of view on that.
Now, that is due to come in fully this time, isn't it? Do you know
timescale?
But that will make a difference. Because up to now, only a couple of departments have had to spew out the information if required, and then they can still be blocked. Mm-hmm. Do you have any blockages? Do you ever get turned down?
We have done recently. Well, I can't remember what that was now, but there was some legalistic reason for that. It will come to me, I'm sure, but there was one recently.
If it compromises.
Have you used it as well, Marion? Yeah. Have you gone for that as well?
Once or twice. I mean, we did it with the John Horton thing. I mean, the things we'd love to investigate are what really went on with the Vision 9 debacle and what is going on.
Well, that's live. I was going to say, that's still going. I mean. Yeah.
But, we've made all the obvious inquiries, we've interviewed everybody that we possibly can, but I still feel that. You know, we've been shown papers confidentially. It's a lot of work. It's very labour intensive, and I've said this many times before.
What about the Jacksons, Tom Jones? That's what people want to know about
doing
as well.
This sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
These are things that, you know, we are still working. They are, as you say, they are still live.
And the thing is, you know, you learn how to sail reasonably close to the wind on these things. Report what can be reported at that point, but there are some things that we cannot sort of substantiate, or actually the legalistic reasons why we can't go any further than we do.
Well, that's back to my point about the forums and the internet,
so
that they can say anything.
Yeah, well, exactly. So who are they going to sue? If they want to sue the newspaper or the radio station, they've got somebody to sue. Something set out on social media, actually, they're kind of freer because they're not going to be sued. Someone setting up a Facebook site complaining about the subject of perhaps the Jackson Constant and so on, they're not going to be sued. If I put that in, not only would the newspaper be sued, I could be sued personally. So you have a higher sense of responsibility, and you have to be more conscious of the risks. And we've all been trained, I think, in things like law and defamation and court, contempt of court, and things that will not cross the minds of people who just type away on internet forum.
And privacy, of course.
Yes, absolutely.
I've had a couple of raps on that.
But how do you react to sometimes the reason given for not providing information is commercial confidentiality?
Well, that's a big can of worms yeah, opening
it's
there.
It's hard to get past that.
Yeah.
They slap that on everything almost now,
that's
right?
True.
That's the quickest way to shut anything down. We can't tell you because we signed a confidentiality agreement. Although, again, we can't, well, it says we can, but we shouldn't to go too much into particular details. But that is a live one at the minute, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it tends to be something that they can hide behind. And their civil servants will say, you can't say that because we've agreed not to. And there's a legal reason why they couldn't. So perhaps they will be sued if that commercial confidentiality would be broken. And so in terms of the electorate, they get annoyed with the papers. Why don't you put this in the papers? Or they get annoyed with the radio station. I've not heard that on the radio station. And it's really quite hard sometimes to explain why we can't do that. There's been a court case recently in which, you know, people said, why haven't you said this about it? And we can't because there's things coming up that we can't say anything about. But we know that. And we are then tasked with this brush of being some sort of government stooge or something or whatever.
Well, we had a good dig at root around with the Scottish Widows,
yeah.
The cashback scandal, which was traced back. Well, the insurance policies that were offered to people for the guarantee was that company was based here. We had a really good root around that. But in terms of the regulation of that company, which is what the interest here comes down to, why was it or wasn't it properly regulated? We've gone about as far as we can go with that. Because the answer, I think, was, well, it has been looked at and it is within the range of normality, it's OK.
Can I say something a little bit more depressing about this whole question? And that is, these stories aren't that well read a lot of the time. They don't sell any extra newspapers. If I've got a story about the steam packet or the TT or a good car crash, in inverted commas, that will sell more newspapers than any sort of investigation into all sorts of things. People actually, as readers and listeners, are actually far more interested in quite, I'm not saying simple, but easy to understand here and now sort of stories than a long-running one.
Can I ask, were they interested in the election, do you think? Because you can see results by the headlines and selling papers, were people overall engaged?
I think the last 2 weeks we haven't got the results of those papers yet, and largely no.
But Manx Radio's got the results of its website on election night.
The
website's different. Websites are different to buying papers. Yeah, that's
it melted down.
You said, are they interested in the election of politics? Well, if 55,000 people, they might be duplicated, but try to access support.
Every video I do, we have a most popular page, and I always get amazed by what people want to watch. And back to some of the more interesting candidates, they were the ones that got more people watching than the people you expect to engage.
I think we're just right. I think there was a great surge towards the end. I mean, there was there were articles in the New York Times. There was a glowing article, actually, in The Guardian. Alan Bell came in here and did a down-the-line interview with WNYC, which is a public service broadcaster in New York, which is syndicated to something like 200 million pairs.
Marion, that means nothing. When you say potentially, I hate that thing because it's maybe five people watching it, listening to it.
Yeah, so all that was going on. We had a lot of hits on our website, but we should say that we've worked out, because that global figure hasn't been issued, but just by sort of writing down number of votes and doing some fairly simple sums on the calculator, that the turnout looks like being about 53%. So yes, massive interest by the 53%. What about the 47% who didn't even vote?
Well, they probably aren't buying the newspapers or listening to radio news anyway, a lot of those people, because they're not engaged in local politics. And a certain percentage are never going to be engaged. Having said what we said about the newspapers, on the website on the night, although we have been sold by Johnson Press, we still get the figures about Johnson Press newspapers because we're still part of the web is still in town, is part of that. And we came 14th, I think, out of all the newspapers on our web coverage in most read stories. So that includes the Scotsman and the Edinburgh Evening News and the Yorkshire Post and the Lancashire Evening Post, big newspapers. So actually on the night, there was a lot of people looking at our website.
Manx Radio's one crashed. It was that popular.
Yeah.
Yes. That's a lot of demand that was going on there, presumably.
At one point, we had to sort of, as Mark Tiley, the programme director, said, he had to press the nuclear button to get people out of bed.
Well, let's take a short commercial break now. We'll return in 3 minutes to continue our look back at the general election.
The Nation Station, Manx Radio.
Richard Butt, Marion Kelly and Paul Moulton are our studio guests as we take a look at last Thursday's general election through the eyes of the media. And I think we've been talking about all sorts of things, not just the election as we go along, but they all spin off from the election. There is a United Nations one of its documents explaining to people why democratic elections are valuable. And one of the reasons, they say, is that through voting, people can voice their opinions, express their hopes and aspirations, discipline the leaders, and ultimately control their nation's destiny. Do you think we're able to do that in our elections? Do you think so?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that's a fair summary of what's happened this time?
Well, I think actually the Island Man voted for change at the election. Five sitting members were booted out by the electorate. Obviously, we had a lot of retirements, Mr. Bell, Mr. Shimin, Mr. Tier, and so on, so that affects things as well. But there's quite a big number to get rid of, five. And existing members, they had a bit of a shock. I think Mr. Robertshaw probably did. He lost about 40% of his vote over the time, and he had a majority of only 7 over Mr. Jockin. And, you know, I think that's probably doesn't stand him in good stead if he wants to go off to be a minister or chief minister, has been mooted in the past, because he's lost a lot of that credibility because he just didn't get the vote in his own constituency.
Well, there were some. We talked about a lot of the manifestos, really, saying much of the same sort of thing in different ways. But there were one or two which were slightly different. Tim Baker's was different. He did at least analyse what he thought and lay down what he thought should be done in the future. And incidentally, the other part of the United Nations thing says that those running for office must state their positions, because if there's no choice, elections lose their meaning. Which is another, we've had the past uncontested elections, but not this time. But Chris Robertshaw, we just mentioned him, his manifesto was slightly different. It had there were a few that were a little bit more in detail. But do you think the public actually, do they read these things,
I'm not convinced that they do. I think they'll watch Paul's videos and listen to the radio and read the paper.
You're talking 3 minutes, aren't you, basically? That's all they can give it, 3 minutes.
Well, it's called the four-par generation, isn't it? Reading web articles. But I know people who sat down, you know, towards the end of the day and thought, right, I'm not quite sure who I'm going to vote for. And this was in a constituency where there were 7, I think that was Arbury, Maloo and Castletown, where they went home and read the manifestos and decided who they were going to vote. But I think that's the exception.
It used to be thought that the manifestos were all gathered together generally by a lot of people, and then they were looked at all together on the Sunday before the Thursday voting. That used to be a tradition accepted what happened. Whether that happens now...
That's so last year. Come on. I was surprised how many, or didn't, not so many, took to social media themselves. I mean, bizarrely, Mr. Gorn was great in his videos. Yeah. He really embraced the social media. Carlos was another one. I'm just trying to think of people who were really taking out this $3 option. What a fantastic price, $3 from Facebook to hit the whole Isle of Man. I mean, you could micro it down to just your areas, apparently. But, you know, where are they? These people that should be moving into this new world we're living in, and Roger, some are still not doing any of that.
You might remember going back more years than I've been on the island, but are printed manifestos relatively new? Because when I was in the island, I think for my first election, someone came knocking at the door, and I said, and he asked me what my issues were, and I was struggling really because I've not long been there, and I said, but I'd really like to read your manifesto. And he sort of stared at me.
No, they're not.
I'm gathering views, and then I'll put something together. Well, so the manifesto was going to be based on what people told him they cared about. And coming from the UK, I really found that.
That's happened a lot this election. I know people who've said, well, my manifesto's not ready yet because I haven't finished talking to the constituents.
Also, they're picking it from other people. That was well known that it was copy and pasting going on. People would see something in someone else's manifesto, go, oh, I like that. And then you see it almost word for word, and you'd know it because you're the printers. But how many didn't do a manifesto? I mean, Mr. Ayres was definitely one that didn't do one.
Didn't do very well either.
He didn't, but I'm just trying to think, it's almost mandatory to do some printed material still.
Yeah, they used to, Marion, quite go back. They weren't as detailed, they weren't as pictorial, they weren't as well printed or as they are today, but they were very often just a sheet of paper with the basics of their policies inside and a picture, sometimes not even a picture on the cover.
Some go into 90 pages, don't they? What was the biggest one you printed?
Well, Phil Gordon's was
40.
A good 40 pages.
I think that Rob Callison had 40, didn't he?
40.
Yeah.
That's huge.
With high production values, lots of colour pictures and lots of text boxes and all sorts.
Expensive
of
as well. Yeah. You've got limited. Is it £2,000 it can spend?
No, £2,000 plus 50p per head of those on the
which should be roughly
register.
The same now because every area is roughly the same.
It's between 4,000 and 3,000.
That's quite a bit of money.
Just under 5. It depends where you are.
No one took out the flags.
Whether or not the great
plus
electorate
free postage.
Read them, but now we've got them. So we can, I'm not going to let them go. You know, we can look at people and sort of judge them against what
they said. The trouble with manifestos is they can be looked at a later date.
That's
and
what I'm
you
saying.
Say, but you said, you know, that's one of the advantages of those of you at home who've got them. Keep them. Put them in a cupboard somewhere.
Challenge
so
them.
They are worth keeping. You mentioned there, Paul, you talked about social media. We had a programme, one of these programmes, only a matter of a few weeks ago, where we had young people, 17 years of age. They all happened to be, coincidentally, students at Castle Rushen, but they were on the programme. And we discussed this with them. And it was interesting that most of them weren't in the slightest bit interested in manifestos. They, as you so rightly say, they thought they should look at it on Facebook. But they weren't interested either in anything of any length.
No, this is
now,
why.
That's the problem, isn't it?
If I do a 10-minute interview, it'll get less views. Well, they drop off. You can see them dropping off after that 3 minutes because it's just the way everyone is these days with their.
There's so much to consume. You have less time to consume any one thing.
I'm sure attention spans. I think my own attention span has dropped as you get through these things. I remember, you know, we saw the highlight of my week was watching The Professionals on the television. I sit one through one of those now, and oh god, this is
very
slow.
Get
on with it.
And you know, we do spend less time looking at these things and so on because we're doing other things.
But picking up on your question, do the young people engage? Did they engage at all with this election overall? When the candidates did knock on the door, were they wanting to talk to the 16 and 17 year olds, or they're just going to talk to their mum and dads? Because I got the impression, I've got a young chap who works with me on MTTV, who's at school, and his feedback is interesting from what they say, that overall there was not engagement going on.
Although there were some super projects out there. I mean, on the Tuesday of election week, St Ninian's had a politics marketplace.
And it got quite heated, apparently.
I think there was about six constituencies that pupils at the school come from. And they invited all the candidates, and I didn't get.
But that was a school.
But a lot of them went.
The school took the initiative there. Yes. See with me. They're actually creating that event.
But they created a place where there could be engagement.
In the past, the schools do it.
Lots of children chose to spend their lunchtime at that market.
My point, maybe the question is, do the youngsters actually want to engage? That's another one.
Well, they've got other things to think about, haven't they? You don't.
McDonald's been closed for a month.
Well, you know, when you get older and you've got a mortgage and you've got a job and you've got these things to think about, and politics is more of a direct impact on your life, then you do take more interest. And I think that that's always been the case.
A lot of the students took a lot of interest at the last election, quite a number of the older ones just in the last years of the secondary school, because they were very concerned, and turns out rightly so, about fees, university fees,
true,
and grants. I mean, that came up a lot from some of the young
people. I think they'll engage if they know that it matters to them. They may think it doesn't, but when I was in schools trying to drum up support or drumming up interest to get the young people in the sixth form to come and do our exit polls, I was really selling it to them and saying, you know, don't think it doesn't matter to you.
Okay.
Because what happens at the election might, you know, is going to, the people in charge are going to determine everything from, you know, preschool places for, you know, your little brother or sister, university fees, house prices, you know, the environment, all sorts of things, you know, how, the island that do matter to
who
you.
Who votes? Let's try that one. What age range votes? We know granny farming is a fantastic way of getting votes. I mean, you know, you go into an old people's home and you can get so many votes there.
Which is why television licences came up as such a big issue later on, even though it's already gone through. Then they realised on the doorstep that over 75 not getting a free television licence anymore was a thing that would change their vote, and that's why that came up as a big issue later on.
So, do we actually know? Is there any facts to say what is the average age? But it's going to be a working sort of age and above, isn't it? Really, that
I don't
bother to
think. I don't think that analysis is.
Why are we not voting on our phones yet? These all these things that we're meant to be the e-island. Surely we should be ahead of the game. We should be able to get up our iPhone and pick your number and push a button.
I think the next election will be quite considerably different, I have a feeling, the way it will be campaigned. 5 years is a long time, as Harold Wilson said. A week is a long time in politics. 5 years ahead, there will be quite a lot more change, a lot more technology changes. I mean, look how much has happened in the last five years. So I think there will be a change. And younger people tend to take the cues from their own peer groups as well now, you find. So who knows what will happen now.
But if Paul's right, I think Paul is right. If more young people may well have voted if they could do it in the way that they want.
And it's quite secure, actually. If you can do Apple Pay, you can do things like that.
Now, we must end today because all our three guests are going to stay with us for the Man in Line, but we end this edition of Sunday Opinion, in which we discussed aspects of the 2016 general election with Manx Radio's news editor, Marion Kenny, from MTTV, Paul Moulton, and the editor of Alamein Newspapers, Richard Butt. So to all three of you, thank you for joining us today. Now, if you, as I said, would like to join in this discussion or add your comments about last Thursday's general election, then join us on The Man in Line, Manx Radio's Sunday phone-in programme, starting at 1:15 after the news, weather and sport. You can telephone to 66 13 68. You can text to 166 177, or you can email to studio@manxradio.com. Our producer was Catherine Nicol, and I'm Roger Watterson, and we look forward to your company after the news.